More fallout from the Facebook files.
The people calling for violence on January 6th used the platform despite Facebook's assurances it was tamping down on misinformation and politically charged rhetoric.
I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News.
$3.5 trillion over 10 years has shrunk down to roughly $2 trillion, and the haggling's still not over.
President Biden's offering some concessions on his social spending plan.
And a boost for booster shots. Now the focus turns to protecting young kids with a vaccine.
It'll visually look different. It has an orange cap and an orange striped label, and it's packaged in smaller packages.
So please stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend. Facebook breathed a sigh of relief after Election Day 2020.
Voting seemed to go off largely without a hitch, without many of the conspiracy theories that flourished on Facebook in 2016. But all was not well. Angry Trump supporters on the platform were coalescing around the rallying cry, "Stop the Steal." 2 months later, some of them would turn up and storm the U.S. Capitol.
How did Facebook get outwitted again by a movement spreading lies about the election? NPR's tech correspondent Shannon Bond joins us. And we should note, Facebook is among NPR's recent financial supporters. Shannon, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You have been looking at internal documents from Facebook. What do they show?
Well, we know Facebook spent years preparing for the 2020 election. It didn't want a repeat of what happened in 2016, of course, when Russians used the platform to interfere. So the company had this emergency playbook. It called these break the glass measures. They were temporary steps to keep the platform safe. So, for example, it downranked posts that might break its rules against violence or hate speech. It means it made them less visible to other people to give them more time to check them out before they spread widely. Mm-hmm. But like you said, the election largely went off without these big issues. And so afterwards, Facebook started to turn off a lot of these emergency measures. And the ones it did keep in place didn't turn out to work so well.
And what did that mean for the Stop the Steal movement?
Well, one thing that Facebook did was to try to limit just how fast these groups that are called civic groups that are related to politics, how fast they could add new members. So it put daily limits on invitations. But these Stop the Steal groups got around that. The first Stop the Steal group, Facebook took down after just 2 days, but more kept popping up in its place, and that kept happening. It was this game of whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. And these organizers were also able to elude detection by choosing their words really carefully and by posting these disappearing stories. And as a result, these groups, they were filled with calls for violence, lies about election fraud, and they were growing faster than Facebook could keep up. And this left a lot of employees inside Facebook really upset. These were researchers and folks who work on keeping the platform safe. And they had been warning, these documents show, that civic groups especially were a problem that Facebook needed to crack down on. But they said leadership just didn't take these warnings seriously enough. So, you know, on January 6th, one wrote on Facebook's internal message board, quote, "Rank and file workers have done their part to identify changes to improve our platform, but have been actively held back." Some people I spoke to who've since left the company said, you know, Facebook really should have kept these emergency measures in place much longer after the election, or even made permanent changes to how it works.
And what does Facebook say now?
Well, the company says, look, the blame for January 6th lies with the people who stormed the Capitol and with the people who encouraged the violence. It says it took a lot of steps to protect its platform, and it's proud of the work it did. And when it comes to, you know, what it could have done, what it should have done, Facebook says, look, these emergency guardrails, these break-the-glass measures are blunt instruments with big trade-offs. Of course, if you slow down the platform for these bad groups, you also have to slow it down for everybody else. You know, that has an impact on growth. And Facebook is trying to strike this balance, right? It says it doesn't want its platform to be used to incite violence. It also doesn't want to be seen as censoring people, which, of course, is something Republicans and Donald Trump accuse it of doing.
Shannon, you've based your reporting on internal research and messages and documents. Please tell us how you got those.
That's right. So recently, you know, we've heard about a former employee named Frances Haugen who's come forward as a whistleblower. She worked on a team protecting the platform and left Facebook earlier this year with this trove of thousands of pages of internal documents. She says she came forward because she thinks Facebook is not making the right trade-offs when it comes to safety versus growth. So she turned those documents over to federal regulators, to Congress. They were also shared to a consortium of news organizations, including NPR. And I should say that Facebook widely disputes her claims.
NPR Shannon Bond, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The gears of Washington, D.C. grind on this week slowly as Democrats continue negotiations over a once and former $3.5 trillion spending package.
The debate has been long and frustrating for some Democrats, but in a CNN town hall Thursday, President Biden brought a bit of levity.
Are you close to a deal?
I think so. You know, look, I was a senator for 370 years. I was relatively good at putting together deals.
NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro joins us now. Domenico, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Where are they? How much closer? Are they any closer to passing what, of course, are billed as the party's and the president's priorities?
Well, as we heard there, Biden was pretty specific and candid in that town hall, more so than we're used to hearing presidents talk about negotiations in Congress. And that's because Democrats appear to be in the final stages of a deal. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said 90% of everything is written and agreed to. From what we know, it looks like the package will be less than $2 trillion. You mentioned that $3.5 trillion original price tag. Mm-hmm. That's because things like free community college is out. Paid family leave is down from 12 weeks to 4, and it looks like significantly raising the corporate tax rate won't happen. Biden said simply he doesn't have the votes to get that stuff through, even though he wants those things, and that's still because of two Democratic senators who've been holding out, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who are opposed, and they're just not budging. That said, $2 trillion still pretty big price tag, and there are a lot of things in there for the left to like. Democrats seem to have a renewed sense of optimism and urgency for this deal. We could see a framework before the president heads to Europe next week for two big conferences. And Democrats, look, certainly need some kind of momentum boost right now because this process has dragged on and has really only served to highlight rifts within the party.
Let's move now to the Supreme Court because they refused to block a Texas law that bans abortions, but the court has agreed to hear arguments in two cases that challenge the law on November 1st.
Yeah, and that's a very fast timeline, which in and of itself should be an acknowledgement that the law is pretty controversial and important. You know, abortions have essentially been halted throughout the state, so it's a real women's healthcare issue right now. As for what the Supreme Court's planning on doing, we learned that the justices are specifically examining the law's unusual enforcement mechanism, which you might remember is in the hands of private citizens. They're empowered to sue anyone who aids someone in getting an abortion. What the court's not going to do is look at the constitutionality of the entire law. Now, the law does remain in place until the court issues an opinion, which that could still take a while, as you know, following the court. Mm-hmm. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor, liberal justice, dissented with keeping the law in place. She said that hearing of the arguments is, quote, cold comfort to Texas women who are seeking abortion care now. And look, the Supreme Court, you know, now with the conservative majority, it's going to be hearing another case out of Mississippi in December. And we're going to be seeing the court define now for generations to come just what types of restrictions on abortions a majority of the justices see as legal.
House voted to hold Steve Bannon in contempt for defying a subpoena from a committee that's investigating the January 6th attack. The Justice Department now has this in their court. What stands out to you here?
I mean, the big thing that stands out to me is just how much Republicans have fought against not just this, but the entire effort to get to the bottom of what happened leading up to January 6th. You know, this is an attack on their place of work. And instead of trying to find out what went on, you know, we've heard excuses made for insurrectionists for many on the right and from the former president, Donald Trump. You know, you might, for a reason for this, you might look back to what Senator John Cornyn of Texas said earlier this year, basically explained why, saying that he stood against the formation of a select committee looking into January 6th. It was about politics, flatly. He said it didn't make Republicans look good. In other words, talking about January 6th wouldn't help them in 2022. So they wanted to talk about other things. As far as this specific case on Bannon goes, it's unclear what the Justice Department will actually do or when. And I think it's going to be a decision that you're going to see from the top levels of the department about how to proceed.
NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And you can hear more from Domenico and me on the NPR Politics podcast. Check it out wherever you find your podcasts. It's been a head-spinning month for vaccine news, and October isn't even over yet.
Federal science advisors reviewed data on booster shots for the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccines, and those are now officially authorized.
Now, officials are considering Pfizer's application to give a lower dose of its vaccine to children as young as 5 years old. Here to talk us through all of this is NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Deffin. Thanks for joining us, Selena.
Hi, good morning.
So, Selena, let's start with reviewing the booster news this week. Who can and should get what?
Well, there's a whole lot of flexibility for people. If you got a Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you're clear to get a booster shot of whichever flavor you wish. Mm. Actually, switching to either Moderna or Pfizer might give you extra protection. And if you originally got Pfizer or Moderna shots and you're over 65 or you have a health or work reason why you may be especially at risk, you can get a booster too.
Got it. Okay. And so now that boosters are sorted out, these federal scientists aren't really relaxing at this point, are they?
No, they are not. We are jumping right into another vaccine palooza here. This time it's all about Pfizer's smaller dose vaccine for kids age 5 to 11. So the first meeting on that is scheduled for Tuesday, but we've already gotten a peek into what's going to happen because yesterday FDA posted on its website Pfizer's application with all of its data and the agency's analysis, its briefing document, which came out last night.
Aha. Okay, and what did those documents show?
Well, Pfizer's data shows that its vaccine is 90.7% effective against symptomatic COVID-19, and that's from a study of over 2,000 children in the age group of 5 to 11. Wow. And there were no serious safety concerns, no cases of myocarditis, for instance, although it may be because the study size wasn't big enough to pick that up. Pfizer made the case that vaccinating wouldn't just prevent cases of hospitalizations in this group. It should also help curb transmission in the broader community and reduce disruptions to school. And the FDA brief said that the benefit of this vaccine is going to depend a lot on where the pandemic is going. So if there's a lot of spread, it would have a big benefit. Whereas if the pandemic is kind of winding down anyway, it's a little less clear. But the analysis concluded that even if there isn't much spread, the benefits of vaccinating this age group may still outweigh the risks. And that's what advisors are going to discuss and vote on Tuesday.
I got it. So if all does go as expected and this is approved, moves forward, when might kids actually get shots?
Okay, so here is the process. The FDA advisory panel I just talked about meets and votes. The FDA then has to grant emergency use authorization, and then the CDC weighs in. So the final step, the CDC director giving the thumbs up, wouldn't happen until November 2nd or 3rd at the earliest. And then, of course, it'll take a couple days to get those shots rolled out.
Yeah, but ahead of the Thanksgiving holidays, which I imagine some parents would certainly be relieved to hear.
For sure.
That being said, though, Selena, is the country ready for this vaccine rollout? You know, I'm thinking back to the original vaccine rollout that really candidly was chaotic in parts of the country.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, experts in this case say there is going to be plenty of supply, which is a good start. Claire Hannon, who runs the Association of Immunization Managers, says she thinks everyone is pretty well prepared here, but there are some differences in this rollout.
The vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds is one-third of the adult dose. It'll visually look different. It has an orange cap and an orange striped label, and it's packaged in smaller packages.
She says that is so pediatricians can get a few hundred doses at a time instead of 1,000, and they'll be able to keep it in the fridge for 10 weeks. They won't need ultra-cold freezers like providers did at the beginning. But then there's the question of, will parents want to get their kids vaccinated? What will demand be like? A lot of questions to dig into, and we'll be covering all of it.
All right, that's NPR's Selena Simmons-Deffin. Selena, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's Up First for Saturday, October 23rd, 2021. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Asma Khalid. Up First is back Monday with news to start your week. Follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And for more news, interviews, books, music, things that are just fun, you can find us on the radio.
Weekend edition Saturday and Sunday mornings. Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.